I'm very delighted today to be here with Stefan Solomon, who is also known as Charlie's Little Corner. And I first heard Stefan talk when he did a small video about why he decided to get involved in the corner. So for those of you who don't know what the corner is a sort of gathering of small channels like mine who like to talk to each other and then like to talk to other new people and see how much we can grow the corner as a place where people can have free-floating, honest conversations about real life and learn to love each other in the process. Would that be a good description?
That's a beautiful description, right? At the top. Wonderful. Yes, there's a lot of them that I can relate to indeed. And so, I'm absolutely
delighted. Why don't you tell us your story and maybe something about your family growing up and then how you got interested in this little corner?
Sure. I grew up in a, for those times, already rather unusual family. My father, he's a Cape colored from Cape Town, from South Africa. And he went to Germany in the early 80s to do youth ministry, of all things. He came from a Methodist family. My granny was a Methodist pastor in South Africa. So he was pretty staunchly Protestant, evangelical back then. He worked for organizations like Youth with a Mission and Jesus, Youth for Christ. And in Germany, there was this evangelical grassroots movement called T-Mobile. It literally was an old bus they used as a T-Mobile to go into the inner cities and do missionary work right there on the streets, especially for young people. And that is how he met my mother. She is a kindergarten teacher from her profession. She by now she's already retired. Last year, I think. And so back then, that was something really interesting and how would you say, non-usual to have a colored South African meet a white German woman in the middle of nowhere in Germany. And in just a very short amount of time, they actually married. And soon my twin sister and I were underway. That was in 1983. So I'm 40 years old, as you can take from that. And that is also, that already gives you a hint of the family frame that I was brought up in. So I've been a Christian all of my life. I've never had a fallout of faith or deconstruction in a sense, though I've had reformations of some sorts and evolutions. I would call it actually more kind of evolutions during the 40 years, due to all that has happened in that time. And yeah, I had a wonderful childhood in the middle of Germany, middle of nowhere, growing up before the fall of the wall and the breakdown of the Iron Curtain. And that is one of the really strong memories I have from my youth. I was like, must have been 6 or 7 years old then. And at one point, my parents just sat in front of the television and they were sobbing their hearts out. And I did not understand what was going on until I looked at the news and realized, oh, something happened in East Germany. And it took me years to realize that that was really, you know, a Kairos moment, not just for them, but for the whole country. And so, yeah, that was really interesting, and participating as a family in the reunion, on a basic level, things like your postal code changed. And that's when you realized, oh, this is getting real. Before the reunion, we had 4 digits. And after the reunion, you know, we had 5 digits, and we all had to learn our new digits for the postal code and that kind of stuff. So that was just interesting. Yeah, so I went to primary school in the middle of Germany, in Hesse. which is the middle federal state right in the center of Germany. Frankfurt is the best known town there, which is interesting, given that I'm pretty much preoccupied with Johann Wolfgang Goethe, and he was born in Frankfurt, and so.
I didn't realize that. Now, I lived in Frankfurt when I was 5 years old.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and all I remember about it, at least where we lived, my dad was in the military, so I don't know if it was a military base or if it was just housing provided by the military, but I remember lots and lots of big trees, very green, and
Yes, indeed.
kind of maybe pine trees of some kind, evergreens of some kind, because my father bought bicycles for my brother and I, and they were the European bicycles with the gears and all that stuff. Because they didn't have that kind of bicycle in the United States at that time. We just had ordinary bicycles with
Okay,
no
that's
special
interesting.
fancy stuff on it. So
That's
these European
fascinating.
bicycles were narrow tires and gears and everything. It was, but I'm 5 years old. I don't know how to ride a bicycle. So they'd set me up on this bicycle and get me going. And then I'd smash into one of these trees over and over and over again. They were relentless.
And you kept going.
Well, I don't think they gave me a choice, and I
Okay.
don't think they were particularly helpful in helping me figure out how not to do that. Now, it might have been my
Yeah.
brother that was driving this thing, because my brother was, when he was that age, he was not very kind to me. He was 5 years older, and he was determined to be the big boss, but anyway, that's my memory of Frankfurt, is these big
Yes,
trees.
interesting. It reminds me of my own first traumatic experience that I've had as a child, trying to ride the bike. And so when I turned 3, my twin sister and I, we both got a bike without gears, just a normal bike. And we got on it, and I immediately fell and hurt myself. I don't recall that it was really bad, but it traumatized me. My sister, she got bruised several times on that day. She fell and she hit her knees and whatever. And after 1 or 2 days, she could ride that bike. But for me, it was like for the next 3 years, I would not touch a bike. I just said, no, this, I'm done. This is it. So I find that just really funny that, yeah,
I don't
you
think I
talking about
learned to ride
bikes
a bike
reminds
then
me.
until we came back to the United States, which was when I was 9. So, yeah, it was probably the same thing. I was pretty traumatized by that whole experience.
And my twin sister, she was faster than almost everything. She could swim before I could, and it took me several years after her to be able to swim. And the same with riding a bike. Yeah, but that's 35 years ago. So we're in Germany. I'm going to primary school, and then out not out of nowhere, but for me out of nowhere, pretty much. My parents decide that we move to South Africa because my father had been given an offer to work there. He had already, since the late 80s, been working for World Vision International, a non-governmental health organization, a Christian-based, and so they had an office in South Africa. And since he was working for them, and he had already been traveling a lot to Africa, though mostly to the northwestern hemisphere, like Mauritania and Senegal and those countries, they decided that we move to his home country. And we moved to Johannesburg, and my granny moved in with us, which was one of the biggest blessing I have ever received in my life, to be able to live with that sainted woman. Under one roof for several years was just a beautiful experience. So, though she could be nagging, because as a pastor, a prayer at lunch or dinner sometimes would amount to listening to a sermon of 15 minutes. But yeah, it was just a wonderful time with her. I would only later come to realize that was a very conscious move. Both in the sense of moving to South Africa, but also in deciding to move to South Africa, by both of my parents trying to keep the family together. Because at that point, their marriage had already deteriorated in a way that just before moving to South Africa, it was already do or die for my mother. And what's and I've listened to some of your story, and so there's something that I could relate to, because as it turned out, in 1998, my father outed himself as openly gay, and I came to learn that that had already almost caused the end of their marriage before we moved to South Africa. And that was the last straw that both of them saw to keep the family together, to enable the kids to have another experience, to be able to live in the country of their father, to meet the family that lives there. And so there was already in the moving to South Africa kind of blessing and curse at the same time involved, which is a very interesting combination. And so within several months, I think it was on Easter Sunday or something like that. Easter, it might have been Good Friday, of all those days, that he outed himself. And then immediately my mother took a trip back to Germany to her parents. And when she came back, she had already a fixed scheme and plan on how and when to move back to Germany. And so we kids subconsciously decided not to talk about it, but we all knew that we would either all stay with our father in South Africa or move back to Germany with our mother. And though we had been raised bilingual, and were pretty fluent in English at that time, we still felt more at home with the German language and with the German culture and our German family. So we all independently of each other decided that we want to move to Germany back again. And within a few months, just shortly after my 15th birthday, we moved back to Germany. And we moved in just around the corner, just like 2 minutes walk from my grandparents, which was also kind of a life-saving geography, because you had the family directly next to us. And we lived in the same town that my uncle worked in and that my mother had been born in. And so there was a lot of connections there already that kind of, laid the ground for us returning there. And yeah, that's so that's
We're
basically,
15 years old at that time. So my daughter was 17 when her dad outed himself as being gay. And so tell me what happened in your heart at that? How did that affect you?
There's a specific moment that I've always recalled, and that I somewhat regret that it happened to me, is that shortly after that fallout, I was in a pretty bad mood. I was really sad and full of grief, and I wanted to get some consolation from my parents. So I stepped out of my room, and we had this large stairway. And I stepped out of the room, and at the top of the stairway, right in front of my room, was my mother sitting at the steps, crying her heart out. And so I felt like, oh, I need to take care of her first, which I did. And then I thought, okay, now I've tried to help her with that, and then I move on, and maybe my dad can help me out. So I went downstairs, and then my father was just sobbing his heart out in the living room. And at that moment, something in me snapped. And it took me several years to be able actually to recover that initial moment of grief and work through it instead of ignoring it. But back then, right there and then, I only saw myself as a possible cause of more concern or trouble for my parents, who were already full of grief, that I wouldn't dare to give them even more problems just by stating that I'm right now in need of their assistance. And so I became very in Germany, back in Germany, pretty quickly I became like one of the class speakers and engaged in school life. And every adult that I met said, "You're so grown up for your age." And back then I took that as a compliment. But today I see it as a really devastating point in my life, that they saw something in me that shouldn't have been there at that point, at that moment. And so at the when I really realized that I had grown up, I felt a double loss. The loss that I had not been able to grieve in the way that would have been healthy for myself, and the loss of my youth at a time that I didn't think it had been lost already.
Wow. Yeah, that is very powerful. And that really resonates. I mean, I can see that effect in many lives. And I can actually look back on my own life and see that, because my parents had a very, very rocky marriage. They were married for 47 years when they died, but it was not 47 happy years. And my dad was an alcoholic, and that had its impact on my mother. And I was the fixer, you know, I'm going to make everybody happy. So I don't remember ever not being grown up.
Okay, yeah.
Right? I
Yeah.
don't ever remember being a child, and I don't remember having feelings until I was maybe 40 years old. Because if you're taking care of everybody else, you can't have feelings. You can't get emotional about things. So, yeah.
The helper syndrome can be very strong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
So
I.
I've never had problems with feelings. I'm a neurotic type, so if you look at the big five traits, I'm high in openness, high in pretty low in agreeableness. Very high in conscientiousness and extremely high in neuroticism.
Isn't that an unusual combination?
It is the this neurotic extrovert that I would call it is such a weird combination, because I love being among people and I'm scared to death about it at the same time.
Oh, wow.
which is so weird. But the hope in me always wins over the fear in me. So it's basically me jumping into the cold water every single time that I'm in a conversation or in larger groups. I run the risk of being anxious, but I've come to experience that it's always been worth that risk. And the moments that I've had, a backlash have never been so bad for me as not to try to keep trying, to keep on keeping on. And so a colleague of mine just recently said something that I thought was kind of a logical problem, or how do you say in English, juxtaposition. She said, "You're so straightforward and direct, and you're so diplomatic." And I said, that doesn't seem to be logically compatible with each other. And she said, "Well, the thing is, that's the art about it. Being able to be diplomatic and direct and precise and straightforward at the same time." And I thought, like, well, maybe that is one of the rare gifts that I can see in being both extrovert and neurotic at the same time. Because being so extroverted and low in agreeableness makes me say things pretty quickly and pretty straightforward. But being neurotic about it also makes me think about how I do not want to, create a negative reaction feedback that falls back on me. And then I'm lost in that loop of anxiety for days. Should I have said something else? Should I have done otherwise? And so this is kind of this dance between those two poles that's constantly taking place in my life.
Well, so you used the word hope when you were describing why you keep going back into situations with a lot of people. Yeah, so you said the hope always wins out. Could you talk more about what you mean by hope?
So it boils down to relationships. And it boils down to my conviction that I'm lost without relationships. I couldn't survive a week alone, a month without someone by my side. I'm not that type of person. So I've always kind of always been in a relationship. I had my first girlfriend when I was like 13, 14, and that relationship held already like over 2 years, which is pretty long time for that age. And it only ended because her parents broke up and their marriage, deteriorated. And that was just a few months before my father came out. So it was like, okay, first the relationship ends because her parents break up and then my parents break up. So that was kind of, strange. But back then, I felt like I had been given and I had received so much joy out of relationship within the family that could not be taken away, even through that suffering and the pain that I was going through back then. And so that gave me this hope, or the conviction that to be able to love completely, you always have to take the risk of being hurt. And so love and suffering kind of go together. They are tied together. And who said, I think it was Catherine of Siena, the great Catholic saint. She said something akin to, you cannot see love without suffering. And the greatest love is only seen in great suffering, or is related to it. And I intuited that back then when my family broke up. And when I, in hindsight, had the first inclinations of an identity crisis. Because what do you do as a 15-year-old boy that's been raised by two evangelical Christians in the faith, when the father suddenly comes out and says, you know what? Your world frame has to be shifted. And I'm shifting it like that. And so it's not just about your own grief and your doubts, but also about what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a man in relation to a woman? What does that imply, given that there's also sexuality running beneath it? And I mean, as a 15-year-old boy, come on. That's definitely a topic that's on the table. And it took me quite some time to work through that. And the most help I got was not by verbalizing all those questions I had, but by living the relationships afterwards that I had. And without the girlfriends that I had after that, I had one, and then I met my to-be wife, which is another gorgeous story by itself. They helped me find my identity and recover my own identity that had been kind of ruptured back in 1998.
Well, the thing my daughter said, it took her a while to articulate it to me, but probably within the first year or so after it happened, she said, "I don't know who I am anymore because I thought I was half you and half dad. Now I find out that the half that was him was all a lie, that the life that he had lived with us wasn't who he really is, or wasn't what he really felt about anything." And so I absorbed all those feelings and ideas that I got from him, and that's part of how I constructed my identity. And now I find out that that whole part of my identity, well, of course, truth be told, if I had known and if she had known what I know now about myself, I wasn't being true either. I wasn't a real person at that point. I was a constructed person, trying to put together my life. I mean, at that point, I was only I was 38, maybe 40 years old, something like that. Well, I was about your age. And I still,
That was the same age my mother was back then.
yeah, I hadn't really figured out it. Somebody explained it to me later. They said, you were living your whole life in denial. And it's probably true because I probably saw all these signals, but I just was living in a fantasy world. We had this great romance. I was so crazy in love with him. And so that's the world I was living in. I had created this beautiful fantasy of this great love romance, and that's what I was living in. I never, he, on the other hand, was miserable the whole time we were married. And I didn't know, you know, I wouldn't have wanted him to be, if I had known how miserable he was, you know, we could have talked about it maybe, but
Yeah, I mean that those were the days back then, because my father, he outed himself to my mother just shortly after their marriage. Or it might have been even before that.
oh,
But
really?
they decided to follow through, because they both back then still believed that as a faithful marriage under Christ, he could pray and live through this through and get through that as basically kind of a phase, which it clearly isn't. And so they were convinced that it was the correct decision to have a family together, because they saw that the family was more valuable than they themselves as individuals. And so, I mean, it must have been absolutely torturous for my mother to raise three children with her husband, knowing that he was gay. But he's all, and I believe him, he always has expressed a profound and deep love for my mother and for his kids. No, not always. So my twin sister, she's had very traumatic experiences with my father that I'm not going into detail here, but let's say I have been more on the bright side of life compared to her. And so at one point, I don't know when it was, but I realized that you can be truthful and authentic at the same time that you lie to someone, which is a weird paradox. But I take it that I think it was authentic and credible that my father did the best that he could. But that maybe both my father and my mother, they from the onset chose to live under that lie consciously. And without that lie, I would not exist. So what gives? I mean, it's so hard to be judgmental about something like that when it comes to your own existence. It's like
Oh,
under
it does.
what
I mean, all of those
value?
things just bring up questions about how I've always used it. I'm using a phrase that's probably heretical. How do I know? But God's economy. There's something about God's economy that we simply do not understand.
Yes.
Because in the first, but my first daughter would never have been married if my husband, who already knew he was gay when he married me, but he didn't tell me. Now, strangely enough, my father said to me before we got married, that guy is not man enough for you. And of course, I was very rebellious at the time, and I thought, "What are you talking about? You know, I love him. He's gorgeous. Everything, you know." But my father saw it. I couldn't see it. So he never told me. But anyway, my first daughter wouldn't have been born if it hadn't been for that. And if he hadn't left me when he did, my second daughter wouldn't have been born. I would never have remarried, and have this beautiful 29-year-old daughter that I have now would never have happened if that. So there are these miracles that come out of these absolutely traumatic experiences that it's so hard to understand how that works. So, I mean, I've just come to the place where I just see miracles everywhere. You know?
Yes. I mean, it is miracle in a sense that it's not something that we can rationally expect and predict to happen in future. But these It cuts both ways, actually. So things can go horribly wrong without anyone being responsible in the end. It's just bad things happen. And that to me was also related with children. So on the one hand, having children was redemptive for me and helped me recover the relationship to my father, because between 1998 and, kind of for like, 12 to 15 years, actually, a long time, there was little to no contact between us. And there were like some short times of convulsive conversations that always ended in conflict and that were pretty unhealthy. So when I got married, we invited my dad, and he was there, but he had such a negative impact on me that my wife said he's not going to visit our home any longer, because that's not good for you. So it had a strong physical and psychological impact on me back then. But when my second child was born, my daughter, I sometime woke up and looked at myself in the mirror and said, "You cannot go on like that. How do I explain to my children that I did not do everything that was in my own power to try to restart a relationship to my own father? I would not be able to look them in the eye at some point in my life, not having tried at least. That's what's my responsibility. I have to try to, break the chains of the past in my family." And so I reached over to him and said, "You know what? Forget the past. I don't care. All I want is you to be able to meet my children, that you and they can, start a relationship." And they did the moment they saw each other. And it was like magic. And although he's been living for a decade in Thailand with his partner, my kids regularly ask me, "Where's Granddaddy? I miss him. How's he doing?" And they've been doing that ever since he first came into our family. So he's their granddaddy. They do have a German grandfather they love, and so that's a second part of the magic. I would not have experienced the redemption and healing had it not been for the family of my wife, because I have parents-in-law that are just I said that to Neil already, and Chad, they are saints to me. What I did not know back then, but I can say now, is I did not marry my wife. I married a family. And that relationship has bonded so intensely that's impossible to break. And so that has saved a lot of my sanity, and recovered a lot of my sanity. And interestingly, in South Africa, just I think it must have been the year before my parents broke up, we were on a holiday trip in the southeastern area of South Africa, and we were, camping in a hut or whatever, and I had this intense dream of me getting my fiance from university, and she had red hair. And that was not a dream, because it was so intense I couldn't stop thinking about it for like 3 days straight, and I had to write it down. And so I wrote it down on several pages, and that dream paper got lost somehow, which is terrible. But when I met my to-be wife, my twin sister, gave me a nudge and said, "You don't you recall the dream you had like 4 years ago?" And that's where, like, okay, the shades came off, and was like, okay, right, my girlfriend has red hair. Okay, right, I'm settled. This is it. We're done. And so I've been together with my wife for Don't get it wrong, 20, almost 23 years, and we've been married for almost 17 years now. And that is partly because until this day, I'm absolutely convinced that that wasn't just a dream, but it was a vision that God gave me to be able to recover from the losses of my own family by building my own family. And it had to be that girl. It had to be that wife. Couldn't have been any other one.
Build hope too, right? The vision
Yes,
gave you
yes.
hope to move towards, to believe that it was possible.
That's so interesting, and I've related to that in other conversations already. When my parents chose to end that marriage and the family deteriorated, in all that strange situation, I clearly saw the light that marriage should actually shine. So, in a sense, the destruction of the ideal actually recovered the ideal for me even more strongly than I would have experienced if I just would have stayed in that ideal. But because I lost it, I realized the value of it and the necessity of it and the importance of it. And yeah, there was this hope in all that darkness at that moment that enabled me to see that.
That's so interesting. I really like that. The destruction of the ideal recovered the ideal. Because, I told you I thought I had this great romance in my first marriage, but when I look back on, reflect on it, it was really more like living with a roommate or like with my very best friend, with a very good female friend. Because we both like to sew, we both like to crochet. We both liked doing art projects together. We liked all the same things. We had all the same ideas. And it never occurred to me that it's not supposed to be that way between a man and a woman, that there's supposed to be two different perspectives coming together to grow something new and different, right? That never occurred to me. So I worked through some of that stuff before I remarried. And when I got married the second time, I had determined I was going to marry a man who was a man. So I married a man who's very different than I am, and that has all its own problems. But what we've discovered through the years is that because we're, it's almost like the two different hemispheres of the brain. He's very much more like a left hemisphere, and I'm like a right hemisphere. So there's a lot of inhibitory stuff going on between the two. But in the end, when the two come together, you get some, when we actually can get on the same page together, we get something way better than we ever could have had with either one of us separately. But it's taken years to get to that place. So, I mean, for people who are married in a situation like that, I say, don't give up because I would say even the first 15 years of our marriage were really challenging. But ever since then, we've kind of grown to understand what it takes to really put into a marriage. And it just gets sweeter all the time. I mean, we still have challenges, but I'm so thankful that we didn't give up after 5 years or 7 years or 10 years, which it could have been easy to do.
And that also ties back to all we've been talking about until now. It's the to keep on keeping on. That seems to be an important pattern of reality. It's not to drop out too early and not to give up too early just because the suffering we experience is almost unbearable to handle. And you can have those experiences of unbearable suffering at many points in your life, and they do come. They are just inevitable. My wife and I, we went through one of those traumatic experiences with with our first child. She was a stillborn, and only very late in marriage did we have a diagnosis of that rare disease that she had. We didn't even know that our daughter was sick until we had a control date at the doctor, and In the beginning, he was joking, and suddenly he became very silent. And that's when we knew something was wrong. And so he sent us to an expert, a professor in Munich, and we went there the next day. And he did his consultation and his studies and kind of stuff. And he said, "I have to tell you that your child is suffering from thanatophoric dysplasia." Now, I've been versed enough to know that Thanatos is the god of death. And so receiving a diagnosis that implies the inevitability of death for your child is such a traumatic experience that it's suffering that's almost unbearable. But my wife and I, through going through that situation, we experienced an unimaginable moment of hope after the burial of our daughter, which was a ceremony with many parents that had suffered similar stories. I think we were like 10 or 12 pairs of parents that had gone through some kind of experience with premature death and that kind of stuff in the last half year or so, and we all had the same ceremony. And after that, my wife and I talked and said, both independently of each other, that we felt that God had actually opened our hearts e even more to having children than before that experience, which is another case of the destruction of the ideal recovers the ideal. And so we soon afterwards we had our first son, Mattis, which we learned later on is a short version for Matthias, which is Hebrew for gift of God. And so n names had has have always had a very strong meaning for us. We gave our firstborn child, our daughter, we gave her the name Leah. And Leah is also Hebrew. And what we did not know back then is that her name translated properly means something akin to the one who has suffered in vain. You just can't make those things up. It's just amazing. And so we are absolutely blessed to have three wonderful kids. And we're still together through all this. It tied our relationship even more together. And yeah, so that is just all the precursor to how I actually got into this little corner. It's just a short.
Before we get there, though, you said that meeting your wife was a magical thing. Is that, were you referencing the dream when you said that? Okay. So we got that part of the story then. Okay.
And so exactly, we got that part. And this was so interesting because my wife and I, we both had a friend, and she celebrated her 18th birthday, and we met there. And we talked the whole night through. We only had eyes for each other, and we didn't care about anyone else. And we talked and talked and talked and talked. And it took us months to realize, okay, there's more to that. But others around us saw that already. They knew, okay, there's something developing there. Yeah, so that was really magical for me. And I want to get back to what you said about you chose a man that is diametrically different to you. Consciously, I've only through experience of many years with my wife come to realize that interestingly, I do have some aspects that are more feminine than her. And so I've come to realize that there's a healthy oscillation between masculinity and femininity within each and every one. And it still does not deny the essential femininity and masculinity of the man and the woman.
Oh, absolutely. I think I'm
And
quite a bit more masculine than a lot of the women that I know, but I still feel like I'm completely a woman. I mean,
and so this is my twin sister. She's also more kind of a sportive tomboy, you could say. But she, her, what's it called? Her psychological advisor. He asked her if she really believed that she was a woman. And she was absolutely shocked by that question. Because he implied that she might actually be kind of transgender or homosexual or anything of that kind. And given her own family history, she was absolutely convinced that she is a woman and she does not have feelings in that sense. And yeah, so you can see that part of the crisis that we today have is tr that there's too much breaking of the poles. So you have femininity and you have masculinity, but instead of keeping the cosmic dance between those poles, what's happening is that we try, or the society tries to collapse those into either or, which is toxic at the end. Because I'm strongly convinced that men have general traits, women have general traits, but there, I mean, there are differences. But those differences are mostly in the on the fringe. On average, I'm still pretty male. On average, my wife is pretty female. But there are certain specific moments and experiences and traits that are much more feminine and much more masculine. And still, my children wouldn't dare to think that my mother, that my wife is not their mother and I'm not their father. So, we have to be careful not to repeat puberty in adulthood. And part of the current discussion taking place in society is we've forgotten what it means to go through rites to become adults, and we've become stuck in puberty. And that loop has been going on for decades.
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. When I was growing up, of course, I'm old now, so I was in junior high and high school in the 60s. And
Oh, wow. Yeah.
it was perfectly normal.
Daytime.
Perfectly. We had a lot of dances at school. We'd have a dance probably every Friday night at school. I don't know. We had a lot of dances. And the boys were always shy about asking the girls to dance. So the girls would go out and dance with each other on the dance floor because we like to dance, you know, and the boys would all stand around looking.
Yeah. Hasn't
It
changed very much.
was nothing weird about that. And when we were in junior high, girls would often hold hands because we were friends. There was nothing weird about that. But nowadays, people take that and they crystallize it somehow that, oh, this means that you must be more attracted to women than you are to me. No, it's a normal developmental thing that people go through. You have these friendships that are very important to your development. And and we're going back and we're replaying that. We're trying to destroy our own history. And now we're trying to take that same developmental thing that everybody goes through and trying to put a new lens on it and saying, oh, it means something completely different than it has meant for 10,000 years, right?
Which again is a typical move for adolescence. You have a thesis, then you have the antithesis, and then at some point growing up and becoming an adult, you have a synthesis of some sorts. And so in a sense, we're still in that antithetical phase and have not reached the point of synthesis that actually is able to recover the tension between thesis and antithesis. And so I've come to appreciate the thought of polarity much more in the last months, thinking those ideas through, because there's beauty in not trying to dissolve either pole, but try to keep the tension between those two. And that is something deeply nonverbal. It's not propositional. You cannot talk yourself into keeping that tension. It's like dancing. the moment you start to think about dancing, something goes horribly wrong. You step on each other's foot. So that's not a good idea. It's more like the musical improvisation that you have through muscle memory. And that is something we have to recover, actually. And I think one of the problems with this little corner in general is that even though we are high in openness, and even though we love forgiving trust in the conversation with each other, so it opens up space, it's bound to language. We're stuck in that language frame. The only medium we have is our language. But to recover an optimal grip on reality is not, I think, not through language in the long run. It has to be nonverbal. It has to be something more primordial than language, because language is is pretty late in the development of humanity.
Well, when you just said now that polarities cannot really be articulated with language, this is the problem that I have had for 4 or 5 years right now, trying to find a way to articulate the picture that I have in my mind about how the process of art works with all these polarities. Because the minute I start to articulate it, you lose the picture. But there's something so it can only be embodied. It can only be embodied through the process of doing the work of having the idea and then trying to bring it into reality through this process of making choices. And every one of those choices is not a choice in one dimension, but it's a choice on in the dimension of all the polarities at the same time. Every choice you make is governed by probably dozens, if not more, of polarities. And each axis, each polarity is a different axis, and you're at a different place on each polarity, you know, like maybe at any given moment in time, I'm 65% female and 35% male, and I'm 25% angry and 75% satisfied. And, you know, every single polarity that's happening at any given moment in time is this conglomeration of many different things that you're making a choice towards that thing. And I think that there's some kind of matrix like that that lies underneath the laws of physics, so that everything, every choice that can be made in physics is constrained only by that matrix of possibilities, and all those possibilities are these polarities meeting at different places in time, right? So I don't know how to put that into words, but I can certainly see the picture. I start trying to put it into words, it turns into this kind of, I don't know, bowl of oatmeal or something. But anyway.
I mean, it's a consequential development that if you look at Wittgenstein, he had his Tractatus was a purely propositional language model. And in later time, he actually became a mystic. Because he ended his Tractatus with the sentence, "What you cannot what you cannot speak of, you have to be silent about. Worüber du nicht reden kannst, darüber musst du schweigen." And that was actually the end of his language philosophy and the beginning of his mystic experience. So,
Didn't end well, did he?
oh, that's a question of if any philosopher ended well. There's a
Well, that's the
website
only
that's
thing I
called
it's
Death
the
of
only thing I
Philosophy.
remember from the only thing I remember from college philosophy is that once I started learning that all these guys didn't end well, I quit listening to anything that went on in the class because I thought, why would I want to go down that avenue, you know?
But so it is with so many artists as well. And so that's also yeah, one could ramble about that probably as well for a long time.
But anyway, you were going to tell me how you got into the corner.
Yeah. Oh gosh. Right. So back in 2019, I was already under severe stress in my life and in work, and turns out in hindsight I had severe health issues as well that went unnoticed for too long a time, and so a bacterial infection could make its way through my body and cause some trouble. And so I went to the chiropractor and physiotherapy and that kind of stuff, and I was like all tense. And out of the blue, that therapist said to me, "I don't know if you believe in something divine, but if I may tell you something, I think you need to recover your connection to the upward, to the transcendent, to the divine." And that just hit me like full front, because how would someone completely unknown to me say something like that without it being a direct message of God to me saying something to me? So I took that as a message, and I took that serious and said, okay, I have to recover something. Something has obviously been lost. And I'm not really sure why it had been lost, but it had come to live in a sense as a kind of nominal Christian agnostic. So it's not that I fell out of faith. It was more like I didn't really give it the attention that you should give to something that you really love. And so I tried to recover that, try to experience God in the waves, so to say. And there were indeed some numinous experiences of me being in nature that grew me closer back to God. I can say that for certain. But that was just the beginning of me going on a YouTube journey to say, okay, well, for Christ's sake, in the sense of the word, for Christ's sake, I'm a Christian. What does that actually mean? And where does that come from? And so I jumped into YouTube and looked for lecture series about the roots of Christianity and the history of Christianity, and I found Ryan Reeves and others that talked for hours about like pre-Christianity and then Christianity and Rome and Greece and all that kind of stuff, and through the Middle Ages, through Reformation. And so it really opened my eyes to the diversity of Christianity as such. It was not this monolith that I'd always believed that Christianity was, which is basically just a stupid idea to ever have, that Christianity is a monolith. But so I was like this short-sighted Protestant raised evangelical in Germany, thinking that I had known everything necessary about Christianity to that point. And boy, was I wrong about that. Thank God I was. And during those binge-watching times on YouTube, at some point, I saw a video by a Catholic bishop. And I said, well, I'm not Catholic, but maybe I just give it a try. And so I watched this Catholic bishop, and he was talking about something even more obscure than I expected. He wasn't talking about faith. He wasn't talking about Catholic doctrines, but he was talking about a to me totally unknown Canadian psychologist. Turns out that this Catholic bishop was Bishop Barron, and this Canadian psychologist was Jordan Peterson. And that was how I entered the two horsemen of this little corner. Must have been somewhere around 2019. And so I went onto that journey. I listened to most of the personality series by Peterson. I was absolutely interested in that because I had been working through a lot of literature for years about the Enneagram, which is a ninefold personality type model that some say predates to church fathers, to early Christians, that had some mystical aspects to it, and that you could say as well might be esoteric in a sense. But I was I felt drawn to that for some time because I mean, I've had that inclination already in my late youth. My parents both had read one of the leading Christian authored books about the Enneagram, and it was just in the shelf, and I had picked that up already several times before. And that was by Richard Rohr and Andreas Ebert, The Enneagram from a Christian Perspective. And so I wanted to know more about myself, and I felt very compelled, felt very compelled by who I was, only to realize that for one quarter of a year I was that number, that type, for the other quarter I was that type, and then I felt that it was another type, and I felt like, this doesn't lead anywhere. This is not really helpful. But it still gave me the openness to, big five traits and personality and that kind of stuff. So I was always more interested in that. I wasn't really interested in his biblical series. Unto this day, I've had trouble sticking to it. I've always tried, I've tr several times I tried to listen to it, but it's never gripped me the way it has gripped many others in this corner. I don't really know why that is. Yeah, so I was listening to his lectures, and I found him to be just a wonderful professor. I wish I would have had that type of professor during my university time.
Yeah, for
I mean,
sure.
I stayed at university for several years. I finished my degrees, and then I went to grad school, and I finished with a PhD. So I've gone through academia, and I've experienced quite a few professors and a lot of teaching there. And still, I think that would have been wonderful to have.
What is your PhD in?
In political science,
Oh, okay.
about public hearings in the German parliament as as an instrument for inter-party conflict mechanism.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It's...
On the one hand, I'm sure it's fascinating, but there's something sounds so boring. I mean,
I my realization during academia was, especially with empirically based quantitative political science, it tries to sell you something as completely fascinating and out of this world while being totally mundane, and try to mask that with high level complexity and statistics that no one understands, which only is meant as a signal towards a small elite realizing that you're part of that group. So there's a clear in-group, out-group distinction that's running underneath that scientific communication there.
Yeah. No, I mean that's an excellent assessment of that, because when I was right after I became a Christian, I was approached by some Republicans, from the Republican Party. My former boss, who was a lawyer, approached and said, "Would you be willing to run for state representative in the state of Iowa?" And he said, "I'd like to add financial support to your campaign." And I'm like, "Why would they be asking me? It sounds so boring." I was mildly interested in the national politics, because I felt that that was where all the big decisions were being made, but state politics just seemed so utterly boring to me. They deal with transportation and they deal with fixing the roads and, just like boring, boring, boring. But I prayed. I was a new Christian, so I prayed about it, and my husband and I prayed about it, and it would mean that I'd have to live at the Capitol part of every year. I'd have to be away from the family, but we prayed about it, and we felt like we got a pretty clear signal that yes, this was something I should do. And the campaign was miraculous on every level, because I was running against someone who had sat in that seat for 4 terms and was running unopposed. If I hadn't entered the race, he would have run unopposed. And I only had 2 months in which to campaign, because they brought me in at the very last possible day.
Wow, okay.
And
Just in time.
just in time, and I won by 266 votes. So it was a very small margin. And so I was confident that's where I was supposed to be, and it was an absolutely amazing 2 years. It was a, I mean, I learned a lot. But it's a long story. It's a long story. Maybe someday I'll tell the story. But But the point is that there can be things that from the outside look completely boring, but then when you get on the inside of it, there's so much going on that you don't know anything about. And then there's all these relationships and there's all these levels and how everything is being affected in many different places. And it also grants you opportunities to have conversations with people that you'd never meet otherwise under any other
Absolutely.
circumstance. And
Absolutely. Yeah.
oftentimes that opens doors to talk about Christ. And I had some very interesting conversations along that line. And a lot of things happened. So, but at the end of it, I also really had, I felt the insight that laws do not change people. And the only way that people ever change is a one-on-one relationship with somebody
Yes.
else. And we can think that passing all these good laws are going to change the world, but it doesn't change people at all. The only thing that changes people is Christ, one person at a time. So,
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more with that.
yeah. So
And
anyway,
I'm not just to
I wasn't trying to
clarify.
diss your PhD or anything.
No, I finished my PhD in 2015. So that's 9 years ago already. But just to clarify, I was all in to that academia stuff. I wanted to be a part of that. But I realized at some point I wanted to be so much part of it that this was a prolific game, a profilic game, not a prolific, it was a profilic game. It's like you have to create a profile and you have to live that profile. And I felt myself that the cost that I would have to bear would have been too high for myself. And my PhD supervisor, he always said, "You were really smart. You could have done this. You could have gone further. You kept yourself small." And that, in hindsight, maybe was just grace keeping me tied to the ground instead of flying somewhere above. And I mean, I had been the situation with our stillborn child, my marriage, that I had already been married when I entered into grad school, which my PhD, which my main supervisor, he couldn't understand at all. He at one point said in some session, "Well, it's pretty unusual that people are married during PhD because you should focus only solely on your PhD and your academic career and that kind of stuff. And people usually only get married by the time they're like postdocs or like assistant professors, whatever." And I said to him, "So do you imply that I should end my marriage for the time being?" And I expected him to say, no, that's not what I mean." But what he answered was, "Well, yes, that is really a difficult question, isn't it?" I was like, "Well, come on, you can't be serious about that." I mean, okay, he's a brilliant mind. He's been hugely successful in the field, even by international academic standards. He was editor of the most renowned academic journal in the field of political science for several years. He brought the editorship to Europe the first time ever outside of the US. So he has all the credentials that he could possibly get. And still there was this weird side to him. And I had many good professors who said to me, "You know what, Stefan? To really get to the top where we are, you need to be a sociopath. You have to have sociopathic tendencies." And they were straightforward about that. And I said, "No, that's not, I'm not willing to bear those costs."
Oh, that's crazy. That's crazy.
And I mean, back then, even though I may have been partly agnostic or partly nominally Christian, I still had this heresy alarm running inside my mind. And at several points at university, I felt that I was being part of a secret club or kind of a cult, where you had to follow some implicit rules and do not break certain taboos, because otherwise, if you did, you would be, called on it. And
That's that hideous strength. I mean, that's the whole plot of that hideous strength, right? Did you feel like Mark stuttered? Had you read the book at that point?
No, I didn't. I mean,
Oh.
I was raised on Narnia. That is one of the early childhood memories. My father, he read all the seven books to us. And whenever we wanted, he did that over and over again. So, and when we were like 7 or 8 years old, there was a beautiful British series that came out, the Narnia by BBC, the Narnia
Oh,
TV
but that was
series.
better than the movies. Way
It's
better than the movies.
unmatched to this day,
Yes,
absolutely unmatched.
absolutely. Absolutely. I totally
Especially if you think about Silverchair and the follow-up series.
so good. It was so good.
I got the DVD. I still haven't. I wasn't able to get that to watch with my kids. I would love to, but I've read several of the books with my oldest 10-year-old, and he was really fascinated about that. And as a kid, I always felt like I want Jesus to be like Aslan. Which is, I mean, as a kid, that's the best way you could introduce Christianity. Yeah. And I mean, there has been a lot of hustle between Tolkien and Lewis over this, that it was too allegorical and too obvious, too on the nose. But to me, it was absolutely magical. Because Aslan is not present all the time. He's mostly absent. But when he comes, he sets things right. And that was my hope that I've always had. It was like, okay, Christ is not always visible and not always present, but when he comes, he's going to set things straight. Don't you mess with him. So this has also been a tension with me growing up, like, okay, all those evangelical Christians that call to Jesus as if he's a romantic poster boy. And I've always felt like, no. He's the one. When he comes, I'm going to bow down and not look at him because I'm absolutely in fear of looking at the light. I don't want to be in that, oh, Jesus, I love you. I want to be on my knees. And that's just another part of that story. Yeah, so where was I?
You were talking about how you ran into Bishop Barron and then Jordan Peterson in the personality series.
So this is where another part of our family story comes in. We've had by then already had two wonderful, beautiful, healthy children. And my wife and I, we were struggling about the question, do we want to have another child? And by that time, we were painfully aware of the possibility that things could go wrong because they had gone wrong in the past already. And so we were in a kind of place where we asked ourselves, do we want to push our luck? Or do we want to put trust in God? And so we were also in prayer about that. And we felt that, okay, even though we have doubts, for whatever reasons the doubts were there, we want to continue. We want to have another kid. And God had always told us that we can have as many children as we want. And so we were kind of shocked because we were prepared for like having another child. But then my wife, she turned pregnant and she had twins. And that was a shock for both my wife and myself. We didn't know what to make of it. We had two kids. Now, how old were they back then? I think 7 and 4. And we both were working full time, or at least she was working part time, I was working full time, and we were absolutely unprepared for having twins because we felt that our life didn't, that wouldn't have fit in. It was like cramped already. Everything was cramped, space and finances and family, all that together. And so we were really shocked, not in a positive sense, just dumbstruck by that. And we wondered, what is going on? We thought that God would say, you know, this is only as many kids as you can bear and you want to have. And how do we deal with twins? But then her doctor said, oh, I wouldn't be so sure about that. Let's wait for another few weeks because with twins, many times nature takes charge. And so within 2 weeks, my wife went to a control appointment. and the heartbeats were not recognizable any longer. So that was 2 weeks of just intense anxiety that ended in an even worse result. And so she had to undergo minor surgery because of that. And she had experienced that already with the first child. And after that, she said, I'm done. This is over. I cannot bear it any longer. And I, at that point, said, I'm behind you. I'm with you with any decision that you make. You have been willing to go through four pregnancies already, or three pregnancies with four kids, of which we have two healthy children. So be it. Then this is done. And her best friend, she said to me, you know what? She might be saying that it's over, I wouldn't take her for granted for that. Just wait a few months, she'll come back. And out of the blue, in the early, yeah, kind of, I don't know when it, I actually don't really recall when it was. Well, whatever. She said to me, my wife said to me, this is not how the story can end. And we've had this poster hanging in our front porch for years now by Oscar Wilde. It's in German. I don't know. I don't know the English version of it, but it's in the end, everything is good, and if it's not good, it's not the end. So that already, that pulled us through. That was the line that pulled us through the fear. And she said, this is not how our story as family will end. We are going to have another healthy child. And thank God we did. And so when she was pregnant, that was right at the beginning of the pandemic in early 2020. So she was pregnant. She was suffering from morning sickness. I was 100% in home office. And so every evening I had time because she went to bed early, like 8 p.m. with the two kids. And so I had time. I took that time to do the housework, do all the chores, get that off her back. But I also used the time to listen to Jordan Peterson, and I bought
It's good
myself,
when you're doing chores.
it is. And I bought myself that book, 12 Rules for Life. And I devoured it. It was like the father that I had not had for 20 years. Literally, like recovering dad from the grave. It was like Peterson was talking to me as if he said, you know what? You haven't had a father in your house for 15 years, for 20 years. This is it. Right now for you, and you better grow up. And I realized that he was absolutely right. I before that, I n had never thought that I was not an adult, but reading 12 Rules for Life, I realized that I was just a sulky teenager and I needed to change something. So I really tried hard to do that. And the best result that I could hope for was that a year later, my wife took me to the side and said, you know what? I don't know what it is with that book or what happened last year, but you changed for the better. And that made me curious about how is it possible that an obscure Canadian psychologist who writes a book about 12 Rules for Life, which is basically just the rules he should teach every teenager as an adult parent, how is it that he so profoundly influences me without it being an openly Christian book or being the Bible itself? What is that? And so I tried to look for some comments about Jordan Peterson on the internet. And lo and behold, there was this Calvinist pastor from Sacramento talking about that Canadian psychologist. And this is how I got onto Paul Vanderclay, and have loved him ever since. And at one point I thought, oh, there's this link every time he does the Q&A Friday, there's this link, enter the Discord. I didn't even know what Discord was. I was like, oh, well, I have time. Just click on it, do it. And then I find myself in the general chat of the Bridges of Meaning Discord server. And within a few minutes, everyone greets and says, hi, how are you doing? And it was such an open atmosphere. And someone says, yeah, you should go to the German language chat. And I said, like, does that exist here? And they said, yeah, sure. And someone hits me up and says, yeah, you know what? I'm from this area. And I was like, you're not serious. That's just 15 minutes away from me. And so that was Matthias Bergmann, who's organizing the Breakwater Festival together with Cassie.
Oh.
And he's been part of the Elsnet of John Van Donk for years now, and he's been participating here, and he's been planting estuary in Germany. He's very active in that area. And so we met online, we met offline. In due time, I've made really wonderful friendships on that German language chat. And so it must have been almost exactly a year ago. That was the where you had the first that was when ChatGPT entered the world. And it was around that time that I got intensely interested in artificial intelligence. And I realized that I have read or seen so many movies that involve robots and artificial intelligence and transhumanism, that kind of stuff, that in a flight of 3 weeks and little sleep, I said to myself, I have to make something out of this. It was literally an idea being born out of myself, with me only able to channel that in a sense. And I knew that, okay, I have to go through this. I have to make this. I don't know why. I just have to do it. So it was kind of a muse or a spirit that inhabited me. And so I took all the content that I could get, and I edited a, I think, 4 and 4.5 hour series about what is a human, which is like from transhumanism to what is hope, what is God, what is sex, what is body, all those issues that are related to the discussion taking place about AI. And I thought, now what do I do with that? And
Was a video?
obviously,
This was a video that you made?
that's a video essay consisting of 9 chapters, and I the best way to I could get that out of myself was to edit it and post it on YouTube. And so I did. That's how Charlie's Little Corner
Oh,
sprang
okay.
to came to be. And so that was the initiation of Charlie's Little Corner. And since then I've done a few conversations in German. I've done also a German long 3.5 hour comment on contemporary politics in Germany, which got really good feedback and some good comments. And apart from that, I've been participating more in conversations in the corner, but not creating as much content as I would like to. I've been working on a Goethe podcast for several years now, and I've been able to just finish one episode that came out last Christmas. And I mean, that's all Goethe. It's just thousands of pages about Goethe, not the primary source, but secondary sources. And I've come to really, really appreciate Goethe, because he's a universe himself. He's a continent that if you step on the one side, you haven't seen anything of it. And it will take the rest of my life not even getting half of what I can learn about him. And that is enough for me to do good.
You said you already made a video about Goethe.
I made a podcast episode about the early years of Goethe and some aspects of his life. There's so much more to him. It's impossible to reduce it even in 1 hour to
Well,
get to the
sometimes
basic
I
level.
run into just a quote here and there from Goethe. I think it might have even been when I was exploring Barfield. I think Barfield
Yeah.
has some quotes from Goethe. I mean, it just blows me away. The insights that he had about biology, as
Yeah.
long ago
Yeah.
as that was, and
If you look at his metamorphosis of plants, or if you look at his color theory, which is already a phenomenological study on, you could say, consciousness actively participating in creating color in the mind, which today we know is part of color. It's not purely physical in the object. It's not just a kind of frequency that we observe. There's more to that. He has always been a very, how would you say, a very visceral type of guy. He experienced everything through the body and with the body, and he saw his eyes to be his most important sensory instrument of the world. And he has diary entries of his Italian journey, which are just astonishing for the mere fact that he can say something with a sleight of hand about, this aspect of a stone, of a geological formation, of a plant, of the clouds in the sky, that no one of us would take notice of or care about. But he was open to everything of that, and he was able to put that into words that are not just truthful, but that are poetically beautiful. It's unimaginable how many qualities come together in that one man at the same time. It's really frustrating at times to see this. He's like really, really far away from us and yet so close.
Well, I'm super excited that you're doing that, because when I first ran into some of these things that I was quotes that I was seeing from him, I thought, I've got to do a deep dive into this guy, but then I have to do a deep dive into everything. So
Yes,
I
yeah.
get lost, and just trying to keep up with the people that I talk to on my channel, I don't get a time to do the kind of deep dive I'd like to do into anybody. But now that you're talking about him again, I'm going to go back again. There's a book that I've been reading, working on for quite some time, because I keep wanting to go back to it, by a guy by the name of Stephen Talbot, about organisms and their evolution. And his work reminds me a lot of Goethe. But the what Talbot has done is just gather all these stories about not only his own observations of animals and creatures and so forth, but stories that he has from other scientists, biologists, the kind of work that they've done where they gather these stories, and you're just reading about how much more deeply complex everything is than we could ever in a million years imagine. And once you start seeing all those things strung together, you're just like amazed. I mean, it's just constant
Yeah.
amazement as I'm reading that book. So I think the next time I read that book, I'm going to try to read it hand in hand with some stuff from Goethe. So I'm glad you're doing that, especially to get the
I'm
background.
glad myself, because I can really say Goethe found me. I wasn't the one who found him. He was already there. If I look at my school upbringing, it's amazing how much Goethe content I've already consumed and went through in the German school system. He's the hallmark figure. You learn some of his poems in like grade 6 and 7, then you start reading some of his plays and novels in like grade 8, 9, and that goes on till high school. And it even goes even went so far that my girlfriend, my wife today, and a friend of mine, for our graduation year, we made a newspaper, and we had to do these interviews and characterizations of everyone in the class. And they wrote a characterization about me, explicitly referring to Goethe and his play Iphigenia on Tauris. and comparing me as a male version of the humanist person of Iphigenia in that play. And I felt that was just funny. But in hindsight, I realized there was so much more to that because Goethe came back to me and said, maybe you should take more time and read about me and read with me. And so I've been doing that for several years now, and it's been an absolute delight because it's a well of fascinating insights, never gets boring. And just when you think you've understood one layer, another pattern opens up and another layer, and then it's layer upon layer upon layer, and it's like archaeological excavation that's taking place for the rest of my life. And so I've experienced the intense joy of realizing that this author will be with me for the rest of my life, and I don't care about any other author. Come what may, at least I've got him and I can do all the research if I'm interested, and if not, I can just read his plays, and if not, he will come back to me. And that's just this wonderful stable part that's been growing for me as part of my story in this little corner. It's beautiful.
Well, I'm so happy that I got to share your story in this little corner. This has been just terrific, but we've been going on for an hour and 40 minutes
Yeah,
already.
it's time flies. It's amazing.
Yeah, so is there any last thing you'd like to say before we wrap up, or do you have any questions?
I want there's a bit, and first of all, I really want to thank you for the work you're doing because I think you perfectly embody part of why this little corner works. Because you are forgiving trust already into conversations before they take place, and you've been able to facilitate the space that enables these conversations, that enables conversations where people, without knowing each other, I mean, this is the first time we are talking over the internet with each other. We've had some written conversation, but not as intense as this thing. And so you are one of the rare figures in this corner that can bring the thinky talky down to basics and enable translation. And that's an idea I've been preoccupied with for several weeks now, is that when we boil down this little corner, in the end, we can at best say that it is an act of translating the propositional into the relational in the hope of it being transformative for those listening to us. And that, I think, has been the hallmark of your channel, facilitating exactly those kinds of conversations.
Well, I think there's a reason if it comes across that way. I think the reason for that would be is that I trained as a teacher of English as a second language. That's what I did my graduate work in. And then for many years, I taught English as a second language. And many times I would be teaching a classroom of people of mixed languages. So there would have been no way to translate from their language into English because I might be working with 12 different language groups, right? But I had to learn a way to speaking with one non-native speaker, hearing what they're saying, and then translating that so the other non-native speakers could understand what that person said, but through the lens of English again. And I noticed in my real life relationships that it also affected the way that I communicated with people because I found myself always trying to bring things down to the lowest common denominator, not in a bad way, but in a good way, trying to make it accessible. And when I was a missionary in Japan, I was very conscious of the fact that the translation of the Japanese Bible into English was done by people who were well-meaning, but they didn't understand about making it accessible to English speakers. And translating the English Bible into Japanese, same way, because They made a lot of things honorific that should have been just straightforward friend language. And instead they made it honorific language, which creates this division that makes it impossible to cross the divide, to completely lose this the God with you aspect of his relationality with us. So yeah, it's very important to me. Plus, the other secret is half of these people I'm talking to, I don't know what they're talking about. It's so far over my head. So I have to grip onto one thing and then get them to translate that down to my level. But then that also means that other people listening who maybe are just like me can get that little bit and have it translated into something that's understandable. So
that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for the kind words. I love doing this. I love meeting all of you. And I think it's just terrific that you have a podcast because your voice is so amazing.
You think so? That's wonderful.
Yes. I love your accent. I mean, it makes everything you say sound not only very smart and elegant, but kind and meaningful because you have this beautiful voice and accent and everything. So
thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have to get
just
working
being a
on
garden
that.
Variety American, it makes me kind of jealous.
Hard work as a German, not to sound like the classical German English. This is not what I want you to know about me. Thank you very
My
much.
God.
No, just kidding.
Well, it is true. I mean, all the TV shows that we ever watched about, you know, the Germans when I was growing
Yes.
up, it was very much the stereotypical.
Of course, what else?
Yeah.
I mean, there's truth in stereotypes. Which I can speak to a lot actually, because I work in a field that has many stereotypes.
Well, maybe we can get together sometime again and you can talk about your work and what goes on there, because
I would love to, because I think that might actually be really interesting also to part of your audience.
Mm-hmm.
So just as a background, I'm a special envoy for refugees with background in trauma and torture, and for refugees with sexual identity. So people fleeing from countries that put draconian laws on homosexuality, female genital mutilation, all that kind of stuff. So it can be gruesome, but at the same time, what turns out to be really, really important is narrative facilitates healing. And part of that process that I'm working in, I'm a federal officer for the Office of Migration and Refugees. Part of my job is listening to stories.
Mm-hmm.
And that also includes the question of being able to dissect credible from non-credible statements and truthful from non-truthful statements. So there's a dearth of questions and thoughts going into that whole process involved with narrative, with credibility, with validity of statements, with truthfulness of claims, and with the effects that traumas can have on recognition, on memory recall, which I think is not just for refugees a hugely important topic. So
let's do
maybe
it.
That might be an idea for a next time conversation.
Yeah, let's do it. I'll make a note of it, and we will probably going to have to be August, because maybe July. I don't know what your summer is like. I know you
yeah
Europeans
we have
take a 6 week vacation in the summer, right?
Schools do, yeah. I don't have 6 weeks off, but I do have a few weeks off in July and in early August. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, let's get something on the calendar. That sounds terrific. This has been just a delight. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Okay. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.